Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, good morning. I wish you could see what I'm seeing right now. Oh, wait a minute. You can. All you have to do is go on to our website, and you can see the pictures that people send in to me. David Hubble sent some great pictures this morning from his latest culinary gardening experiment. Beautiful camellias. You'll see that. And then he used an old St. Francisville, Louisiana recipe to make a camellia wine. Isn't that interesting? With ratafia, a brandy-based liqueur infused with fruit or flower petals. You know, David, it's very curious. I don't know how the camellias are going to taste, but if they've been, we're doing that in St. Francisville, that's really good. The other day, and speaking of roses, I had an ice cream made with rose petals. It was absolutely delicious. I love the taste of rose petals. I don't know that the rose petals of the knockout roses we've been talking about are as good as some of the other rose petals, but it's an interesting thing, rose petal ice cream. A lot of flower petals can actually be quite delicious, quite delicious. Some of you will be very cautious about which flowers you experiment with, but there are a lot of edible flowers out there, and we should talk about them. Hibiscus flowers. David, I'm going to say hibiscus flowers could make a really interesting wine, and that's something we should talk about too. Interesting. Dan wants to talk about wants me to talk a little bit about tomato seedlings, and so I'm going to do that. Listen, here is what do we know? What is the difference between a hybrid tomato and a regular breed of tomato, as Dan calls it, and then something called an heirloom? Well, let me say right off the top that this thing we call heirlooms is right now not much more than a marketing ploy. Ooh, did I say it out loud? Listen, there's some tomatoes out there that are classified as heirlooms that are good and that are good for you. But it's mostly a marketing ploy. You should be careful about that when you go out and look at that. An heirloom, strictly speaking, this is a... In the old days, an heirloom was essentially a land race. It's what we would call a plant that has been grown in the same place for years and years and years, and the seed has been saved for years and years and years to grow in the same place. And that seed, particularly with something like a tomato, becomes very adapted to that place. So the Amish heirloom tomatoes that everyone talks about, like and Brandywine, they're really great if you live in the Brandywine Valley. But they may not be so good in Alabama, because an heirloom traditionally was just a land race, a thing that the seed had been saved from year to year to year. Now, there's something funny about tomatoes. Funny about tomatoes, because tomatoes don't cross anymore. They don't have sex anymore. That's the truth. They basically pollinate themselves. There's not crossing between two tomatoes in normal conditions. So if you save the seed from tomatoes in your yard every year, the likelihood is, even if you're growing multiple types of tomatoes, that the seed from each tomato, with some important exceptions, will be exactly like the seed that you grew the year before, because it's basically the plant is pollinating itself. There aren't two parents involved. So that's what after a while, when you save an heirloom, that's what happens. You basically are creating a self-pollinating tomato that is going through an unnatural reproductive act. It's, that's right. Heirlooms, what the saved seeds are, it's not a normal kind of thing. It's something that humans did to tomatoes to keep them from having sex so that each tomato is identical to the one before. A normal tomato is a hybrid tomato. I know that sounds weird, but a normal tomato is a hybrid tomato that has two different parents. And we do control crosses and other things, but that's what a tomato normally wants to do. Oftentimes, hybrid tomatoes have more vigor. They're more vigorous. They're stronger than heirloom tomatoes because they do have two parents and because they do have a greater ability, a greater potential ability to fight off diseases. And that's what having sex and having two parents is all about. Is being able to fight off those diseases. So there's nothing particularly bad about a hybrid tomato or particularly good about an heirloom tomato. You just have to go through. The problem with a hybrid tomato is you don't know what you're going to get if you save the seed. Am I making sense? That's right. You don't know what's going to happen if you save the seed because the seed is not going to be exactly like the parent. That's the way nature works. If it's an heirloom tomato, if you save the seed with some qualifications, you're going to know that the plant that you get the next year is going to be exactly like the plant you had last year. It's just a question of whether that heirloom is really adapted to Mobile conditions. So there it is. And if that seems weird or confusing, give me a call. Yes. So Sean, that may be the case that a tomato raised in a single family home is parent home is less successful. It's a complicated thing. If you have questions about tomatoes and what it means, don't be misled by the term heirloom. It doesn't mean it's better. It often means, because the heirlooms we collect come from Russia or the Brandywine Valley in Pennsylvania or wherever, it often means those tomatoes are less well adapted to Mobile. Carmelo is a good, and I think it's a hybrid. But Carmelo is a good variety. I know they have standardized some Carmelos as heirlooms. There are some Carmelos that are hybrids. They're good tomatoes. They have done well for us. They have a good season. They're good slicers. I recommend them. They're fairly disease resistant. They're actually greenhouse tomatoes from France, if I'm remembering correctly. So they're used to the humidity of the greenhouse, which means they do a little better here in Mobile. Isn't that interesting? So there's one way to think about it. Boy, I've got some other questions I'm going to have to get to. I'm going to look it over so y'all continue to send me great pictures. We'll have a lot of fun looking at that. And David Bracken always asks me great questions. David, I want to answer your question because it's a really good one. What are these things called, cypress ponds? And they're scattered around Baldwin County. We're going to talk a little bit about them. They're really interesting. They have really interesting things in them. They have, David, many names. We're going to get to that. And we've got some, as we should, we've got some questions about bananas. And what to do about them. Billy Bob, that cluster of bananas looks like it's been hit by some frost already, and that's okay. Well, let's talk about what you do about it. We'll talk about that when we get back. Tony and Fairhope got a soil test, but we'll talk about what soil tests mean, and I'm going to figure out what his questions are about as well. So there we go. We'll deal with that when we come back. But good questions this morning. Lots of great questions. Lots of great things to think about this morning. So feel free to give us a call, 251-343-0106. We'll follow up on your questions. Hey, Dan, I hope I gave you enough information. Dan wrote me in and says, talk about heirlooms versus hybrids and what it takes for a hybrid to be stabilized enough for it to become a breed. You know, one of the things when we're just to follow up, hybrids are, that's natural. That's what's supposed to happen. That's why there are two parents. So you have a hybrid. You're a hybrid. I'm a hybrid. Thank goodness. That's a good thing. It's why, I guess it's why sex was invented in the first place. But if you want to stabilize it so that the parents are exactly like the children are exactly like the parents, that's another story. We'll come back and talk about that here when we come back from our break.
Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yo, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Hey, Tony, before you do anything else, before you touch that nitrogen, give me a call because something's wrong, man. You put 69 pounds of nitrogen for 1,000 square feet. Ooh, boy, your front yard is going to be dynamite. Generally, we put on somewhere between 1 and 5 pounds of nitrogen per 1,000 square feet, and that's real, actual nitrogen. How much fertilizer you put on depends on how much nitrogen that fertilizer has. So if you were doing cottonseed meal, for example, which I recommend, Tony, listen, I recommend it before you make a mistake, because I can see a mistake coming here. Cottonseed meal is really simple. You don't have to do all these major calculations. You don't have to freak out about it. If you were doing cottonseed meal, I mean, I would say maybe you might put on somewhere between 10 and 20 pounds of cottonseed meal per 1,000 square feet. Now, that's 10 or 20 pounds of cottonseed meal per 1,000 square feet for your lawn. That cottonseed meal has about 5% nitrogen, 5, 6, 7% nitrogen. So you see the difference between what we're trying to do. We don't want 69 pounds of nitrogen. Ooh, boy, that ain't good. I don't think of anything that would thrive in 69 pounds of nitrogen. It would burn it all up. So, Tony, give me a call. We're going to talk about where you got these numbers from. We had lots of interesting questions this morning. We were talking about, I don't want to miss any callers, but I want to get back to this hybrid thing. Let's talk a little bit about hybrids and how to save seeds for tomatoes and what all these things mean. Dan, Carmelo is a good tomato. It's a good tomato. I don't know whether you have the hybrid version or whether you have the stabilized version, as you call it, the one that has been stabilized so that it is no longer having, so that basically all of the tomatoes are exactly like their parents. And you don't have to go back and if Carmelo's a hybrid, that means every year you have to go back to the two original parents, neither of which are Carmelo, and you have to breed those two together to get Carmelo. So it's a little bit, it's the way nature works, but it's more of an involved process. And so you got to have somebody else do these control crosses for you. And that's where the hybrids come in. That's the downside of hybrids is that you don't get to make the crosses, you don't get to control them, and you don't know that the person who's making those crosses is going to do it every year. That happened with one of my favorite tomatoes called Dona, which was a great tomato. But then the guy who was hybridizing him said, I don't feel like doing it anymore. So they just quit. because they said, you know, the only person who ever really liked that tomato was this guy down in Mobile. So they quit. To stabilize a hybrid, you need to select from it year after year and plant it out. It is a big pain. Some people do it. I wouldn't put it high on your list of priorities right now, Dan, because it's going to take a while to stabilize those. Let me tell you something else. If you're saving tomato seeds, this goes to all of you. If you're saving your tomato seeds from year to year, most tomatoes, as long as they're not a hybrid, as long as they were identical to their parent, okay, that it was a stable plant, the thing we call an heirloom, whatever we want to call them now, a non-hybrid tomato, those tomatoes are going to come true from seed unless you have some of the smaller tomatoes that species tomatoes like, well, there's several of them out there. They tend to cross readily with other tomatoes. And there's a more of a higher risk of pollen contamination with some of those other tomatoes. So you have to be a little careful. You got to be a little bit careful. They're much better at sharing pollen. So you might get some crosses there. My advice to you is, unless you're really prepared to deal with the logistics of all of this and thinking about it very hard, don't worry about hybrid and heirloom right now. Find the best tomatoes that grow for you. Carmelo's is a good tomato. It produces in a good amount of time. It's going to get pretty tall. In our climate, most tomatoes get taller than they're supposed to. They're going to get about, I would say your Carmelo will easily get 5-6 feet tall. That means they're going to flood over if you put them in a small cage. They're just going to double over three times. So put them in a plenty big cage. Really, really important thing to do. Tony, let's talk about this fertilizer issue. Now, tell me where you're coming from with 69 pounds of nitrogen.
I took a soil sample. First of all, I've got a lot of oak trees, and I had taken down three trees. So I'm going to do a flower bed there. But I took a soil sample with combined from my Gorsha and my flower beds in my front yard. And it went off. Old Time took this for me, but it sent off to a place in Georgia. But it's, I thought it was a typo, but it plainly says 69 pounds per 1,000 square feet, 3 pounds of nitrogen, 4 phosphorus, 3 potash, 0 magnesium. Is it a typo?
Okay, so what that means is that if your fertilizer has 3% nitrogen, that still seems awful high. Something is wrong. Do not use that. I can't tell you where it's wrong. Even if the fertilizer you were using had, a half of 1% of nitrogen, maybe I would say you could use 69 pounds of it. But even oak leaves have almost a pound. I mean, oak leaves have half a pound of nitrogen per volume. I just can't see that's right. Listen, let me just tell you, on your lawn, here's a very simple thing. Can I make it simple for you?
Absolutely.
Would you believe me if I told you? for lawn fertilizers, you can use the cottonseed meal. It'll work very well. It's very easy. It lasts a long time. Mm-hmm. You're going to need somewhere between 10 and 20 pounds of cottonseed meal. With Zoysia, it wouldn't hurt to go to the higher end. It probably won't make a lot of difference if you do, but it wouldn't hurt to go to the higher end of that. If you want to put on a little more than 15 pounds per 1,000 square feet, you could do that and not worry about it with Zoysia. I might worry about it with something like Centipede, but not with Zoysia. It releases very slowly, and it's good. It's a nice fertilizer. It's perfect. When did you install this Zoysia?
2 years ago, and it is just terrible. I think it's a shade problem. So why we've cut down 90 oak trees since we've lived here.
Yeah, and so here's the interesting thing. One of the interesting things is lawns that are in shade require less nitrogen, and in fact, you almost have to apply less nitrogen to lawns in shade because they don't have enough. They're not doing enough photosynthesis to process the nitrogen you're putting on there. And nitrogen has other negative effects in the yard. But cottonseed meal is definitely the safest thing to do. I have no idea where that 69 pounds of nitrogen came from. But, boy, I mean, your front yard would be glowing if you put that much on there. It would not be glowing in a good way. It would be burning up.
69 pounds is lime. Lime, not nitrogen.
Oh, lime. I'm sorry. 69 pounds of lime. I'm so sorry. Well, that's a different thing. So let's, okay, we'll be back. We're going to take a break. We'll be back.
The rain is falling through the mist of sorrow that surrounded me. The sun.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Tony, I'm glad we solved that. 69 pounds of lime, it makes sense. It's not going to cause any damage. It will have some impact. It's probably not going to solve your problem. If you think you've got too much shade, I know what that means. It means you've got way too much shade. And there's just not enough. I mean, plants don't eat fertilizer. They don't eat lime. They don't eat that. They eat, if anything, they eat sunlight. They actually manufacture their own food through the process of photosynthesis. And it is the sun that is central to all of this. You don't get enough sun, it doesn't matter how much nitrogen or calcium or other things you add, because the plant can't process it. That's what drives the machinery. That's the real gasoline in this whole operation. So it is the sunlight. So you got to have that, or the machinery just doesn't work, and it doesn't matter how much of the other things you add. But adding the lime will make a small difference, and it won't hurt. 3 pounds of nitrogen is high, in my estimation. It probably won't hurt. It's probably more than you need, particularly given how much shade you have. I would reduce the nitrogen. 3 pounds of nitrogen per 1,000 square feet is high. 3 pounds of actual nitrogen. Now, the fertilizer you use, that is going to make a difference. But 3 pounds of nitrogen would be equivalent. I have to do the calculation, but probably something like about 25 pounds of cottonseed meal per 1,000 square feet, somewhere in there. Any rate, just be careful. I would, again, go with my recommendation. Put on 15 pounds of cottonseed meal per 1,000 square feet. Put on the lime. Put on the lime first. Put on the lime now. Let that lime sit for a while. Let it get several rains on it. Sometime later this spring, put on your cottonseed meal, and we'll see what happens. It probably no more than 15 pounds of cottonseed meal per 1,000 square feet. Okay, Tony, I hope we got through that. Is Miracle-Gro bad for your garden? No, it'll work fine. It's kind of an expensive way of doing it. It's not the only thing your garden needs, Terry, but you can use it. We can talk about the circumstances in which it really, really works. Hey, do I get to talk right now? I want to do it because I have this rare opportunity. Well, all right, Rich, let's while we're at it, let's get to this Oakley fertilizer. I'm listening.
Well, Bill, I've taken your advice. For the last 3 years, I've been growing Meyer lemons, satsumas, and blueberries, and I put the cottonseed meal on there every year. Now, I've been mulching a lot of oak leaves lately, and it looks really fine and granular and really good and dark and rich. I was like, can I stop putting the cottonseed meal on there and use the oak leaves ground up?
Sure. I would probably, yes. There is, as I said, if you may have caught when I said in my last bit of conversation, oak leaves have about as much nitrogen pound for pound, they have as much nitrogen as horse manure. Now, obviously, dried leaves way less than horse manure, but they have a lot of nitrogen in them. And they're going to break down very slowly. It's now that you've gotten things kind of geared up, that'll help. You'll have to add those oak leaves every year, and that greatly reduces your need of cottonseed meal. The good thing about the cottonseed meal is that it usually, the effects of it last more than 1 year. So your earlier applications of cottonseed meal are probably still working to some degree in the soil, particularly if you've added organic matter. You've probably stored some of that nitrogen potential, and it's still working in the soil. So I would say a better way of looking at it is if you add oak leaves, you could probably skip adding cottonseed meal every year or two or 3 years. But eventually, because you're expecting so much out of those trees, you're expecting lots of fruit, and we've bred these trees to produce an extra amount of fruit, they're going to need a little bit more grease. And that grease is the nitrogen. The sunshine is what drives it, but you need a little bit more grease. And so I think you're probably going to have to add cottonseed meal about every two or three years, even with good doses of leaves. There are some people who never fertilize their trees. I think they don't perform as well, and I think they're probably not getting good crops. And I think it stresses the trees after a while if they don't get any extra fertilizer. But you can certainly skip years. Did I equivocate too much?
Too much.
How much?
Both.
Say it again.
If you're adding both leaves and the cottonseed meal, is that too much?
No, that's a good thing. The good thing is that it does not, to use both is not a problem, because both are very slow release forms of nitrogen. They don't become available until soil creatures break them down. The leaves actually help to store the nitrogen. I know that sounds weird, but the leaves store nitrogen really well. So if there's an excess of nitrogen, the leaves can help store it through the living process of what's going on in the soil. They actually end up storing some of that nitrogen. So you're going to be just fine. Again, I would not add the equivalent of more than 15 pounds of nitrogen per 1,000 square feet, maybe up to 20 pounds of cottonseed meal per 1,000 square feet. So as long as you're not adding just exorbitant amounts of cottonseed meal, and I doubt you are, you're going to be just fine. I mean, I would say for each tree, maybe put on, you know, about 5 to 10 pounds per tree, along with the oak leaves, and you're going to be fine.
They're getting to be about 15 feet tall now.
Well, put on 10 pounds.
For each tree?
But you'll be fine. Huh?
For each tree?
Sure. If you wanted to put on less, you could. I would say for each tree, my target would be somewhere between 5 and 10 pounds of nitrogen per tree if you're using the oak leaves.
And the same goes for the Meyer lemons and blueberries?
I think it would be just about right for those two. So it's the good thing about using the organic, the good thing about doing things the way it's been done for 400,000 years, 400 million years, is that You don't have to do it with a measuring spoon. It really isn't. You don't have to be that precise. And cottonseed meal and oak leaves provide nitrogen in that old-fashioned way. So you don't have to be really very precise. They actually help to sort of moderate the highs and lows of fertilizers. So you end up, no matter how much you add each year, as long as you're using those organic sources, you're not really going to end up with a disaster one way or another.
Now, if I'd like to mix some bananas in there, when is the time I put them in the ground?
Bananas, go ahead and put them in the ground in March. They're great. Great time to do it. Bananas actually take more nitrogen. That would be one of the few plants I'd say, oh, let's put closer to 20 pounds of nitrogen per plant. Mm. They actually can use up a lot more nitrogen, but they love that. They'll still love those oak leaves. Boy, they love it. Not 20 pounds of nitrogen. Probably 2 years from now.
Okay.
It is unlikely you would see fruit the first year, unless the banana you bought was already very, very tall, in which case it would have a hard time settling in. So don't expect it the first year. It's going to happen the second year, and you're going to have to call me back because we're going to have to talk very carefully about how to save that banana from 1 year to the next. And in fact, I think I'm going to do that next week's radio show on that, because there are a lot of people who are going to have potentially a great crop of bananas this year, but only because they saved the stalks that were left over from last year.
Okay, just tell me what your favorite variety for producing fruit is.
Good. There are two. Orinoco, it's the old banana that people grew around here for years and years and years. Orinoco, it's named after a river in Brazil and wherever else it flows through. The Orinoco River, O-R-I-N-O-C-O, Orinoco. It's very old, very, very common here, but a great banana. I actually think it's, as a cooking banana, it's probably the best that we can grow, and very good, but it's a great, delicious eating banana as well. The is Rajapuri, and it's sold as Rajapuri. I don't know what the real name was, but Rajapuri. It's an old Indian banana, does great for us. It doesn't get too tall. It doesn't get blown over very easily. That's one of its virtues, and it is very good about producing bananas nearly every year once it gets really well established.
Fantastic. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Hey, what's up? Vic, you there? Oh, dear. Well, we'll come back to Vic.
I think he's there.
Soon. Is he there? Vic, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Go ahead. You got me.
All right. Well, you shoot me a question. What's up?
Yeah, I was wondering about a good vine, climbing vine, to use for privacy. I currently have some thumbersia growing, which produces a beautiful flower twice a year. But I'd like to have something in addition. But I would like to get something that would get a height of 10 to 15 feet without a problem. It would be wonderful if there was such a thing as an evergreen vine that would stay green year-round, but I know that's kind of a reach. So what would be your suggestion?
No, there's lots of great evergreen vines. One of them is an easy one to find is crossvine, C-R-O-S-S, crossvine. And it's a native vine. It's evergreen. It has really pretty flowers and really nice, and it's evergreen. There is, and the other one, of course, I shouldn't forget, there's another great one that's fairly easy to find, really easy to find, our Carolina jessamine. Carolina jasmine, beautiful yellow flowers. It's evergreen. There is, and Charlie's telling me I think that I need to take a break. But Vic, let me come back and talk a little bit about evergreen vines and how to grow them. And there's another one that I want to talk about. But Charlie, am I right in hearing that I need to take a break here? Yep.
Welcome. Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah, welcome back. It's the Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Listen, evergreen vines. There are a lot of great evergreen vines. In fact, it's easy to think of them. It's harder to find them sometimes. But crossvine is a great one. The yellow jasmine is a great one. There's a couple of problems with vines that you leave in one place that you're using for a screen. And Confederate jasmine is another. All of them have the same problem. And that is that they tend to lose their lower leaves as the vine develops. And so you get all of your foliage at the top and none down below. There are a couple of ways of fixing that. One, you can lean your, you can sort of lean your trellis, so that there's enough lean to it. And there's an easy way, there are some easy ways of doing that. Just put a little bit of lean on it so that the top leaves don't shade out the bottom leaves. You see what I'm saying? There's another vine that I really love because it solves this problem without a lot of thinking. It's called the evergreen clematis. It's one of my favorites. It is one of my favorite evergreens vines. It has beautiful leaves that are these long, luscious, beautiful leaves. Absolutely stunning. And it holds its leaves all up and down the stalk much better than most vines. Not sure why. Probably has something to do with the fact that it is its leaves are more shade tolerant. That's why they're longer. But it is a great vine. The evergreen clematis, Clematis armandii, the Armand's clematis. It used to be very common. It is very hard to find now. If you find it, it's one of the great evergreen vines. So there it is. I hope that told the story. Listen, there's a lot of things I need to follow up on. One of the things, David P., yes, indeed, David, I'm blaming this whole show on you for asking about cottonseed meal. No, it's a good subject, cottonseed meal. Nothing miraculous about it. It's just, you know, it's just practical. It's just good. Yeah, it doesn't, you don't mess up with it. It's available. It doesn't cost too much. It's not too precious. It just works. It just works. The other David B. over there in Baldwin County, David gets excited about all sorts of good things. He's excited about carnivorous plants. This week, he's excited about something very important. You'll notice in Baldwin County, and to some degree, you'll still find them in Mobile County. These little areas, they're kind of like weird little ponds that just suddenly appear in the middle landscape. Nobody dug them. They're just shallow ponds. They don't hold a lot of water. They can be of various sizes, and they'll be rimmed with cypress or tupelo and sometimes other really neat shrubs. In fact, I saw there's a lot of rare plants associated with those, and I'll talk about them in a minute. David grew up calling those cypress ponds, and I think that works. The cypress that grow in those ponds aren't the normal cypress that grow out in rivers. They're actually the cypress we call pond cypress, amazingly enough, because they're associated with these upland ponds, these ponds that just appear in a landscape. A lot of times these ponds don't seem to have any drainage. It's kind of funny. There's a lot of names for them. Grady Pond. David, you listening? Grady Pond is an old name that you hear a lot. Citronelle Pond. Citronelle Pond, named after Citronelle, because there used to be a lot of them up there. It's in that formation. The Citronelle Ponds was another name. Gum Pond is another name we hear for it. On the Carolina coast, they have a lot of other names. And there's some evidence that the big giant ponds that are very famous on the Carolina coast, the Carolina Bays, as they're called, that those ponds may have a similar origin to the ponds here. And there's a lot of debate about what caused those, because they're very weird. It's very hard to understand them, but they're really interesting. And they were very important to a lot of species, a lot of our endangered species, the dusky gopher frog, which is now highly endangered, basically was probably now only is in a few ponds in Mississippi. Used to be quite common in Alabama, we all believe. But because all those ponds were wiped out, we lost that, You know, I don't know what the good Lord thinks about that. Because if he made that, if he had anything to do with that dusky gopher frog, he might be pretty upset about wiping out all those ponds. He said, "God, you know, I put a lot of trouble into that dusky gopher frog, and then you just go and say, I don't care, I'm gonna wipe out his," you know. So, flatwood salamanders, these really used to be really common, really abundant. They were in these ponds. They're almost all gone. Lots of birds. I think wood storks probably took advantage of them. Lots of other birds took advantage of them. Lots of creatures. Indigo snakes, the most beautiful large snakes in North America. These great, beautiful, benign, sweet, sweet-tempered indigo snakes probably use those ponds as well. Lots of beautiful plants. Bartram's pinks, just big, beautiful, incredible flowers. Big, beautiful hollies that are the Amelanchier holly was incredibly beautiful, part of those pond systems. And so all of that was part of it. We drained a lot of them without thinking about the consequences and without really dealing with it. And they've lost the habitat around them in some cases. It's one of the great losses of the Southeast was the loss of those ponds. We can call them cypress ponds, Grady ponds, gum ponds, named for the tupelo that grow there, tupelo gum. We can call them citronelle ponds. We can call them bays if you like, because they're very similar to the Carolina bays, though we've got a lot of names for bays, don't we? We could call them a pocosin. That's another name for a very similar type of pond that occurs on the Carolina coast. But all of these things were part of our ecosystem. We're losing them rapidly, David. So now that you know, you're getting a good start. David, I like it when you get to thinking about things. You come up with good solutions. Hey, Jennifer, let's talk a little bit more next week. You give me a call. Let's talk a little bit more about what's making your fruit tree leaves curl and bubble. I think if you're talking about citrus, I think we're talking about citrus miners. Not a problem. Ignore it. That's the best advice I can give you. Call me next week. It doesn't really cause a problem for the tree. It just sort of causes you anxiety, and you don't need to be anxious. You got other things to be anxious about. So since it ain't bothering your tree, don't let it bother you. There's some things that are happening to make those leaf miners a little less common. We'll talk about that next week. Boy, we talked a lot about a lot of things. Dan asked me a great question before right here. What are good soil creatures other than earthworms? Dan, I mean, I got a whole encyclopedia I could unload on you. And I'm going to do it next week, just since you asked. There's a lot of great creatures out there that are really important. And let's come back to where we started, because there's a buzz right now in my big toe, and it's starting to work its way up my body past my ankles. It's going to be in my chest about February 15th. It's going to be like I got a buzz all over my body because the seasons are about to change. Those changes in seasons are important to plants. It's important to your garden. It's important to birds. Hey, you know what? It's important to you. You're just enough like them. You grew up in the same situations. Those seasons mean a lot to you. Open yourself up to them. Open yourself to what it means to be part of the seasons, to experience the seasons all the time. That's how we got started this morning. We're going to be back next week talking in more detail about how to prepare for this spring season, which starts, in Mobile and Fairhope about February 15th.
Far.
Cornbread, butter beans, then back to North Carolina.
That's all right.
And corn.